go ahead here with equipment. Thank you.
Brian, I'm going to put you guys on mute just so that you don't hear a bunch of background noise, and I will unmute when I need to say anything. So give me a second if you ask something and I haven't responded yet. Take me a second to unmute.
All right. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Commissioner. Let the record show that it is 9 o'clock a.m. Central Time on May 29th, 2013. We're present in the commission hearing room in the state capitol in Bismarck, North Dakota, for the public hearing scheduled in the matter of BEK Communications Cooperative, switched access, price schedule et al., PSC case numbers PU-13-108 through 126 inclusive. On March 28, 2013, the Public Service Commission requested the Office of Administrative Hearings provide a procedural administrative law judge to preside in this matter. My name is Bonnie M. Fetch, and I am the duly designated procedural ALJ. At this time, I'm going to ask for appearances for the record, and I will begin by asking who is representing the North Dakota Interstate Access Coalition.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Hoag on behalf of the coalition.
Thank you, Mr. Hoag. Will there be any advocacy staff presenting evidence this morning?
No, Your Honor.
And who is representing the commission?
Your Honor, Ryan Norell, attorney for the North Dakota Public Service Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Norell. Is there anyone else present who is going to be providing testimony today? There are a number of people sitting here in the commission room. Identify yourself by raising your hand if you're going to be providing testimony.
Good morning. My name is Douglas Meredith. I work for John Sterilakis Incorporated, and I'll be providing testimony or discussion about the filing that was filed on behalf of the client of the carriers.
Thank you, Mr. Meredith, is it?
Yes.
All right. Members of the Public Service Commission present today are Brian Kalk, Commission Chair, who holds the portfolio in this matter. Randy Christman is present here in the hearing room, and Julie Fedorchik is present by telephone. Commissioner Fedorchik, if at any time you cannot hear what is being said, please let me know.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So far, so good.
Thank you. Okay. At this time, I'll ask the commissioners if they have any opening comments. Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just thank everyone for coming out today, and look forward to Senator Hoag, Representative, not Senator Hoag, I always want to call, but now you're Mr. Attorney Hoag, I guess, and Doug Meredith's testimony today. They've both been in front of this commission different times before, and I look forward to hearing, I guess, your detailed explanation about the case in front of us today. But in a broader sense, I know we've got folks from different parts of the industry in front of us as well today just listening. But you know, if I do have a concern about what's going on here today, it's the glide path, if you will, that the FCC has put the states on and the role they put the North Dakota Public Service Commission right in the middle of it. We just had a work session yesterday, which will be a motion later today, about how we're defining our exchange boundaries inside the states and how the broadband mapping project is going to lay out to that and how eventually Connect America Fund will give certain groups money and take some away from other things. But there's all these FCC decisions, and some are under appeal, some aren't. And really trying – the role that we're, I think that we're put into is we're supposed to referee these things without having a lot of jurisdiction to do some things if we don't like what's coming. So maybe, Mr. Meredith, in your testimony today, you could address on some of those things where – if there's some pertinent cases that may affect some of the things going on today, let us know about that. And then maybe how you see some of these things getting finalized, because it's just there's so much going on what the FCC is deciding, and the states are trying their best to implement all these things. given all the different competing interests, and it's quite confusing, quite honestly. So I look forward to the testimony, but also, too, I look forward to this commission getting even more involved in NARUC and other levels on some of the telecom communities, because I see that North Dakota, South Dakota, and some of the states may share some of the same ideas. And I think that the states in the Midwest really need to stick together, because a lot of these policies are not being developed to benefit the Midwestern states, is my bias, I guess. So with that, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Chrisman.
Well, Your Honor, most of what I was going to say has already been said now, but just to reiterate a couple of the key points, you know, in my time both working with the telecommunications cooperative and also in the Senate, one of the things that I've appreciated about the Public Service Commission has been the fact that, you know, I think there's kind of a tradition here of providing needed regulatory oversight and doing it in a good way, but not becoming overbearing. And so I kind of worry with FCC rules and court rulings whether too much is being placed in our lap to where we're doing things that have been done just fine without the state regulatory oversight in the past. So I sure want to be cautious that we're not venturing out and getting into things that we ought not be, because North Dakota has had a tremendous telecommunications system in place for a long time, and I wouldn't want to see it dragged down by unnecessary regulation. At the same time, we have to do the things that we need to do, so we want to watch that line very carefully.
Thank you, Commissioner Chrisman. Commissioner Fedorchik, would you like to make opening comments? Hello? Commissioner? I think we've lost Commissioner Fedorchik.
Sorry about that.
Oh.
Sorry. I didn't hit the mute button. My apologies. I don't think I have anything else to add. I share some of the concerns expressed already by my colleagues, and look forward to learning more about this issue and asking some questions of the experts in the room.
Thank you, Commissioner. On March 13th, 2013, the North Dakota Intrastate Access Coalition, consisting of quite a number of companies, filed revisions to North Dakota Tariff Number 1 in compliance with FCC rules governing intercarrier compensation. On March 27, 2013, the Commission suspended the intrastate switched access price schedules filed in each of the cases listed in this matter and issued a notice of consolidated hearing, scheduling a public hearing for today. On the issue of whether the intrastate switched access price schedules filed by each of the companies should be approved by the North Dakota Public Service Commission. And this is the hearing procedure we're going to follow today. The coalition will present its case for approving the price schedules. And as I understand it, we have one witness. And after the testimony from the coalition's witness, the staff attorney, Mr. Norell, may ask questions, and then the commissioners may ask questions. I may also ask any questions. Following the coalition's case, just in case there is anyone present today who wishes to testify in support or opposition to the proposed price schedule revisions, I will call one more time to see if anyone would like to testify. Documentary evidence must be introduced and marked as an exhibit and admitted into the record in order to be considered. I have received one large set of documents, Mr. Hogue can explain if this is going to be an exhibit and if it's going to be the only exhibit. The burden of proof is on the North Dakota Interstate Access Coalition to show, by the greater weight of the evidence, that the switched access price schedules filed in this matter should be approved by the Public Service Commission. The proceedings are being recorded. Any disagreement with the final decision of the commission, has the any party has the right to request rehearing, reopening, or to appeal the decision to district court. The expense of transcribing the proceedings will be the responsibility of the party appealing the decision. Are there any questions to concerning the procedures? Mr. Hoag or Mr. Norrell?
No, Your Honor. I just have one.
Mr. Norrell?
I would request that Mr. Patrick Fawn, also from the staff here at Public Service Commission, be granted permission to ask questions should any arise.
I think that's probably pretty standard procedure, and he will be allowed to ask questions. Mr. Hoag, did you have a
Your Honor, just question? A question. The exhibit that you alluded to, is that admitted presently, or is that something we need to offer at the conclusion?
You need to offer it through this hearing.
Okay. We will do that at the conclusion of Mr. Meredith's testimony.
Thank you. Anything else, counsel? All right, then. We'll proceed with the coalition to present its case in this matter. All witness testimony at this hearing is taken under oath and is subject to penalties for perjury. And by law, I am required to inform witnesses about the penalties for perjury. Perjury is any material misstatement of fact. In North Dakota, it is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $5,000, a maximum 5 years in prison, or both. Mr. Hoag, do you want to proceed with your witness? And Mr. Meredith, why don't you begin by spelling your full name, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My full name is Douglas Duncan Meredith, D-O-U-G-L-A-S. D-U-N-C-A-N, and the last name Meredith, M-E-R-E-D-I-T-H.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth under pains and penalties of perjury?
Yes.
Thank you.
Your Honor, consistent with our past practice, we do not have a question and answer session for the commission. What we do have is Mr. Meredith will provide an oral narrative providing an explanation of the tariff filing and some recent technical amendments that were filed. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Mr. Meredith.
Is that acceptable, commissioners?
That would be fine with me. The only thing I would ask is with Senator Mr. Hoag, would prefer we ask questions as they arise or hold all our questions till the end? If it's more of a discussion, if you prefer the witness to do it all.
If you have questions, provide them to Mr. Meredith as soon as you want to.
Yes.
Whatever makes most sense to you, commissioners.
All right.
All right. At this time, Mr. Meredith, we'll hear from you.
Very good. Your Honor, may I be permitted to stay here, or do I need to go to the witness box?
You may stay right where you are.
Very good. Thank you. Well, good morning, commissioners. As you are aware, this particular hearing is dealing with the Interstate Access Coalition, the Intrastate Access Coalition for North Dakota, and it represents a number of small rural telephone companies throughout the state of North Dakota. The coalition, as was represented in the introductory material, filed a 173-page document in March, and March 13th is when you received it. It's dated March 12th. And this particular document outlines the pricing schedules and the pricing information that follows up from last year's filing. And subsequent to the March 12th filing, there was a filing on May 24th of this year dealing with a few Scrivener's errors and technical matters that I will review in detail so that everybody understands what that particular document refers to. It's also 172 pages. It's essentially a repeat of the March filing, but it has the corrections that are identified in one of the tracking sheets. But before I get to that particular document and go through in detail the material listed therein, I did want to take the opportunity to provide more of a background and an overview of where we are, why we're here, and where we're going, and in particularly in responding to Commissioner Calk's invitation to talk about the partnership between the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and representative state regulatory bodies like the North Dakota Public Service Commission. The FCC in 2011 adopted an order, and it's called appropriately the Transformation Order. And in that November order, the FCC adopted a series of rules and regulations that and policies that ultimately will fundamentally transform federal universal service support programs and intercarrier compensation. Particular to this particular matter is the this proceeding is the transformation of intercarrier compensation. Intrastate access is part of intercarrier compensation. Intercarrier compensation are the charges, the rates and charges, I should say, between carriers in providing service to end user customers. Long distance providers are a good example. Long distance providers are in the industry called inter-exchange carriers. They're providing exchange traffic or traffic telephone calls from one exchange to another, usually at a fee to the end user customer. And the wholesale arrangements between the two carriers is what we're talking about, and that's called access. That's because the inter-exchange carriers are granted access to end-user customers, either for originating traffic or terminating traffic on the local exchange carrier network. So that's why we call it access, is because it's access through a particular local network. And the FCC, in their particular decision, decided that intrastate and interstate access, terminating access, should go to a bill and keep regime. That is to say that eventually no rates or charges will be applied to the carriers that are exchanging traffic between each other. Now, that particular process is regulated by a certain glide path. In 2011, the order came out. In 2012, in July of 2012, the first step was taken. And in that particular proceeding we had last year, we described in some detail the first step in making sure that the intrastate terminating access rates were conforming to the FCC's glide path or rules.
Mr. Meredith, if I could, was that the one half? Two questions I have at this point is is there any legal appeals that you're tying into what we're doing today? Yes. And then the one we did last year, that was reduction by 50%, wasn't it?
Correct. The response to the second question is yes. The first step was if there was a rate differential between the intrastate access terminating rates and the interstate terminating access rates, that the first step was to take half of the difference in the first year. So we were reducing intrastate access rates by one half of the difference. With regard to the first question that you pose, are there any legal matters pertaining to this particular issue? And the answer to that question is yes. The U.S. Court of Appeals 10th Circuit in Denver has received and consolidated a number, nearly 30, appeals of the transformation order in various respects dealing with universal service and in other aspects dealing with intrastate access or the intercarrier compensation. And in particular, the FCC matter for intrastate access is being appealed because of this particular proposition. The FCC claimed that it has authority over intrastate terminating access and has then issued or regulated intrastate terminating access rates going down to a bill and keep regime. a number of parties, competitive local exchange carriers, state regulatory authorities, consumer advocates, disagree with that position the FCC has taken and have taken this matter to the 10th Circuit for review. The process right now at the 10th Circuit is that the FCC, the court has received initial briefs, reply briefs, and surreply briefs. Are coming up on these particular matters in the early June timeframe. Oral arguments for both matters, universal service and intercarrier compensation, are scheduled for November of 2013, and then a decision on the all of the matters before the court would be sometime thereafter, probably in the early 2014 timeframe. So there are issues, but there are no stays. There have been no successful injunctive relief granted to any of the parties. The parties have provided their material to the court. The court is reviewing that in turn, and as the old adage goes, the wheels of justice grind slowly but exceedingly fine. And so we expect a decision in the 2014 timeframe for an order that came out in 2011.
Are you aware, Mr. Meredith, of any North Dakota entities that have filed in with this appeal?
I am not aware of my recollection. I do not know if any of the rural carriers in North Dakota are a specific named party to any of the petitions that went to the 10th Circuit. I do know that the National Telephone Cooperative Association is a named party at the court, and they represent a number of companies that are they're the association, and rural carriers in North Dakota are members of NTCA, is what I should say.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. So the matter last year, or let me describe again, back up just a minute on this. I mentioned the term glide path, and I want to explain that fairly clearly so that everybody knows what that means. Intrastate terminating access rates, switched access rates, and interstate terminating switched access rates deal with those inter-exchange carriers when they actually deliver a call to an end user in a particular exchange. Could be anywhere in the country. The inter-exchange carrier buys access through an access tariff, and they pay a certain rate. And for end-office switching, for example, it's a per-minute of use rate. They pay that to the terminating carrier to deliver it to the called party. The FCC has indicated that they do not like the intrastate rates, because all the states had different rates because they were regulated by different regulatory authorities. All these different rates, the FCC said, that's not in the public interest, and therefore we're going to make those intrastate rates in the first couple of steps equal to the interstate access rates. And thereafter, we're going to take the combined rates that everybody's using down to a rate of zero. And that's what is called bill and keep, because you don't – that particular concept is dealing with – we don't have a wholesale per minute of use exchange rate. The rate is zero. The access rate is zero. The bill and keep scenario will eventually appear in 2020. So every year from 2012 to 2020, we will be here talking about the next step, because we phase down in sequence all the way down to zero. And what happens to the revenue for this particular scenario is the following. If there is a rate difference, then the carrier would have been, without the FCC, would have been given revenues generated from those rates. Since the FCC is reducing the rates, the revenues that would have been recovered are recovered through different mechanisms. The first mechanism is a federally mandated access recovery charge. The access recovery charge is in the interstate tariff, not in the state tariff, because it's federally governed. And that amounts to, at most, a 50-cent increase in end-user rates per month for local service. It's somewhat similar to the subscriber line charge, which is at $6.50. That's an interstate federal subscriber line charge. The ARC, the access recovery charge, is set at a maximum of 50 cents per subscriber per month for residential users. And that increases every year by a 50-cent increment up to $3. So after 6 years, the ARC will be a $3 surcharge on end-user customer bills.
Mr. Merritt, if I could cut a couple more questions to jump in.
Chairman Kalk?
I guess I should ask the Honor to ask the questions. Your Honor, may I ask a couple questions?
That's fine. Just identify yourself so that on the record we know who's speaking.
Thank Your Honor, does Commissioner Kalk request to ask the witness a couple questions?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Merritt, the 2020 timeframe, do you anticipate companies complying before 2020? And if not, I mean, does it benefit them? I would assume it would benefit them just to keep getting these fees as long as they can. But do you anticipate anybody getting done before that time frame?
That's a very good question, because it anticipates what's going to happen in like 2017, 20, and 2019 time frame. At that particular point, the permanent of use rate will be far less than one penny. In fact, 0.007, so it's 0.0007. cents per minute. And as a result, I anticipate that some carriers will probably say it costs more to bill it and collect it than the revenue they receive. And so they will essentially say, I don't want to bill it anymore. Just to put it in perspective, if memory serves me, and you can do the math for me. At a 0.007 rate, it takes nearly 1,500 minutes to generate $1 of revenue. Okay, so there you can see that there's, and to produce a bill and to send it out to a particular carrier, there's a lot of back office costs related to that. And so at a certain point, it's not going to be, from the bottom line, from a particular carrier, it's not going to be beneficial to actually bill the minutes. Now I can't provide any testimony saying that a particular carrier has anticipated that or is going to do that or has told me that they're going to do that, but I can see that from looking at the industry that there's going to be a time where some carriers are going to say I'm not going to do the carrier access billing function for the small amount of revenue that I'm getting.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could have one more,
please.
Maybe who's benefiting here? I mean, we're lowering cost to someone. Do you think this is a customer benefit? Do you think this is a wireless benefit? I mean, who's the winner here, if there is one, in your opinion?
For the transition, for the intrastate, the bill and keep scenario, the bill and keep scenario allows end users who are large users of telecommunication services to realize lower bills for their long-distance service. The industry is going through a transition, a technical transition now, going from time division or old technology to the new technology, which is Internet Protocol or IP, transmission. And the FCC recognizes that there's this technical transition that's going on, and they're trying to react to a situation where revenues, intrastate access and interstate access revenues, have the potential to decline, seriously decline, and not exist anymore, because as you move to Internet Protocol, there's lots of other opportunities to not pay those charges. And so the FCC anticipates that the end-user customer ultimately will benefit. But one of the things that they're doing is that they eventually, when terminating access is eliminated, what they have done is they have effectively eliminated the long-distance carrier, because the long-distance carrier does not have a retail relationship with the end-user customer like it does now in this 2020 regime. They have a wholesale relationship. They'll still provide transport to and from locations, but the retail relationship to the end-user customer will go away. And the end office carriers, the carriers that have the local loop was what we call it, the connection to the customer, will be able to provide a full array of services, not only the local services, but also many cases, I can anticipate that they would provide nationwide calling based upon flat rate scenario. The FCC in the transformation order discusses this in some length and talks about the policy, the overall policy, and what they're looking to is they're looking to the wireless model. The wireless carriers don't have inter-exchange carriers. You cannot pick a long-distance carrier if you have a phone, a mobile phone. The mobile phone carrier that you subscribe to is the one that is your retail relationship. You only have that one relationship with the customer, with that carrier. And they are looking to that model and saying, hey, well, the bill and keep scenario works really well with these AT&Ts and Verizons and T-Mobiles of the world, so therefore we should apply that particular model to local exchange carrier services. Ultimately, the FCC believes the end-user customer benefits, but there may be some customers that benefit more than others. The proverbial grandmother or grandfather in tennis shoes. The grandma in tennis shoes is what we describe a person who doesn't make many long distance calls. She receives some calls possibly, but not. She only makes local calls. Her experience is going to be quite different than a medium sized or large sized corporation. Her experience is going to be that she's going to see a $3 increase in basic local service with this ARC surcharge that she's not going to really see much perceived benefit for. And so when we look at end-user customers, it's important to realize as a commission that there's segments of customers. Some are benefiting more than others in that scenario.
Your Honor, one more follow-up to that. This is kind of the heart of the issue for me is that the FCC believes that people that use wireless devices will benefit in the long term. But the niche market, if you will, someone that just has the phone hanging on their wall, when these costs go down to zero, their costs have to go up, I would think.
The wireless model that they're using, the FCC believes that wireless right now does use bill and keep. And so they're saying, well, we're going to use bill and keep on basic traditional phone lines. And we believe that customers will benefit. They make that in a general statement. They do not recognize or distinguish or segment the customer population to say, okay, does the person who just has a phone hanging on the wall, who doesn't really use much long-distance service, are they going to benefit from this transition? And on balance, the FCC believes that customers in total will benefit. But they do have the access recovery charge does exist there, and it is a $3 increase in basic local service for a phone because it's a federally mandated charge.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. So we were talking about the revenues and about talking about this access recovery charge, and as I mentioned, it's for residential basic service lines. It's 50 cents per line per month, increasing at 50 cents a year, up to $3. Now those are the maximum amounts. If you didn't need that much revenue, then you wouldn't have a 50-cent increase. You could have a 44-cent increase or a 22-cent increase for a given tranche or step in that six-year period. The rules do allow carriers to actually increase over that six-year period up to a $3 rate. So the $3 is really at maximum, but it might take longer, is what I'm saying, longer than 6 years to get there.
Yes, Commissioner Christman.
Who determines who needs it? Is that a federal decision based on whether the state, whether the country as a whole needs 22 cents or 50 cents?
Yes.
Or is, are all states going to be different then again?
It's actually, Commissioner, by carrier. It's a carrier-specific determination as to whether it's 50 cents or 20 cents or whatnot. And that particular determination is based upon a certain procedure that the FCC has established on this revenue recovery. And so what the FCC has done in 2012 last year, I should say, they've taken 2011 revenues and they've frozen certain portions of carrier revenues to say, okay, that's the amount. This is the eligible recovery amount that you are capable of. It includes the interstate revenue requirement for all switched access services. It includes reciprocal compensation that carriers would have received between competing carriers. And it also includes an estimate of intrastate access, terminating switched access revenues that that carriers were receiving at that time. And so the FCC froze that amount as a eligible recovery amount, and then they are saying that is the amount of revenue you can recover. We will take the access recovery charge and apply it to that revenue amount, and we'll also take any other revenues that you're getting for those legacy, those transition services that you're getting, and apply it against that eligible recovery amount. If the eligible recovery amount is small, then you can see that the access recovery charge, the ARC, might be 25 cents or less than 50 cents, I should say, because with all of the residual transitional revenues plus the small amount of ARC, you actually are able to recover that ERA, that eligible recovery amount. And if you don't, then what happens is the FCC has established a new federal universal service mechanism called the Connect America Fund hyphen ICC, Interconnection Compensation Fund, and that recovers the rest of the eligible recovery amount. So there are two processes here. The FCC envisioned a scenario where access revenue that was formally recovered by interexchange carrier or paid by interexchange carriers, that amount, that revenue amount, is now recovered through an ARC and also through the CAF ICC for carriers. Now, the eligible recovery amount is a pot of money. It's frozen, a frozen pot of money. It cannot increase, but in fact does decrease. The FCC has said that eligible recovery amount goes down by 5% a year. So each carrier's eligible recovery amount is a set amount of money, and that is reduced by 5% each year going forward. If you, price cap carriers, these are carriers not subject to this particular proceeding. These are the larger carriers like CenturyLink. Their eligible recovery amount goes down by 10% each year. Okay. So there's a glide path for the eligible recovery amount to eventually go away. Okay.
Follow-up questions, Commissioner?
No, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
So that's the process for intercarrier compensation deals. You know, we're in this transitional period from 2012 to 2020, and you may have been asking yourself, well, what about originating access? Because all we've been talking about right now is terminating access. And what the FCC did in 2011 was to actually propose in a further notice of proposed rulemaking similar reforms to originating access. And they actually asked a series of questions. Should we do this? Should we not? If we do, what should we do? Should the transition period coincide with 2020, or should it go about to 2022? A host of questions about originating access that have yet to be decided. The FCC still has not taken action on the originating side of this access. And so what we have is we have reforms that are requiring a transition of terminating access, but no reforms yet for originating access. And let me just be very clear on what originating and terminating access is. If an inter-exchange carrier, a long-distance provider, has a retail relationship with an end-user customer, and that customer picks up his or her phone and calls the aunt in the neighboring state, then that inter-exchange carrier would originate a call and request access through the local exchange carrier's network to that customer. And then the customer would dial the phone number. It would go through the network, be hauled by the long-distance carrier to the other state, and then terminated to another local exchange carrier who grants access to the terminating customer, the called party. So what we've done is the FCC has taken care of the terminating side, but they have yet to do anything on the originating side of the access regime. So everything you see in the March and May proceeding, the papers that you have there, 172 pages, all deal with terminating access changes, no originating access changes. Okay. Now, with regards to the court in dealing with Commissioner Calk's invitation to give a little bit of an overview as to where things are, the Tenth Circuit Court is reviewing the matter as I've described. It's not likely that the FCC will prevail in that court decision. You know, it's very high odds for the FCC to win, and for a variety of reasons. Most prominent is the deference that courts usually give expert agencies when dealing with technical matters. And you're familiar with that. There's state precedents in that as well. But on the federal side, that deals with the Chevron USA case, and it's called the Chevron analysis. And that particular matter, the courts will defer to expert agencies for their jurisdiction. The one matter that really is a snag for the FCC in the Tenth Circuit is this very matter that we're dealing with today. Does the FCC have jurisdiction to regulate intrastate service? And that is a very interesting question for the court. And the FCC's explanation of its authority may very well not meet the court's judgment, and the court may do either vacate part of the order or remand the order for further discussion by the FCC. But that's where the court lies.
Your Honor, I had one follow-up to that, if that's all right.
Yes, Commissioner Calk.
Doug, my perception has been that this doesn't matter, political organization, who's in charge. The FCC is kind of going to do this. I mean, do you see that we've just recently had a change of the head of the FCC, but do you anticipate if there would be a major swing in 2016 that there might be changes in this, or is this one of those things that it's got the support of the people it needs to and it's going to stay in place?
I would. This is speculative,
of course.
But I would think if I were to bet, I would bet that it would stay in place, even if a change in 2016 were to occur. And the reason why I observe that is one, you're absolutely correct. Chairman Janikowski has resigned, and the nominee Tom Wheeler is been appointed and is subject to Senate confirmation. I don't see a change if Mr. Wheeler is the chairman. I don't see a change in process for the next 4 years. Now in 2016, things are going to be well underway, and if the court doesn't do anything in 2014, we're going to be in 4 years of transition, and our rates will be very, very low at the time, and there'll be a fully operational ARC and CAF ICC recovery mechanism in place. To unravel all of that from the FCC standpoint would be quite an undertaking. It would really be a tar baby that they would not want to touch.
Your Honor, one more follow-up.
Yes, Commissioner.
And we had probably a very similar discussion last year, so every year I get a little more detailed understanding of all this. It seems to me that the backdrop of all this is that the regulatory entities know they can't regulate the Internet. And so the Internet protocols are never going to be regulated, so you've got to do this to some point, get them to mash up. So maybe I don't like what's going on at the state level, but it seems like that's the driver that most people agree on, that you're never going to regulate Internet traffic, so let's get these down so they can at least have level playing field. I mean, how would you view that statement?
Yes, I would agree. Let me amplify. The FCC, very early on, actually in the late 90s, and then even more strongly in the early 2000s, declared that internet service was not a common carriage service. It was not under Title II of the Communications Act of 1934 as amended. Instead, it was under Title I, which is a very light regulatory touch. When VoIP comes on, VoIP is Voice over Internet Protocol. So this is essentially local call, you know, telephone, it's communications, but not regulated as common carriage. And when this particular service comes online and becomes better and better and actually is definitely improving over time and is used by a number of end-user customers, the FCC has now a kind of a dual regulatory track. They're going one direction with VoIP or Internet Protocol type activity, and then they have common carriage for other services. And they have this gap that they have to reconcile. And this is part of the reconciliation. This transformation order is trying to reconcile those two diverging paths.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Please continue, Mr. Meredith.
Thank you very much. With regards to originating, as I mentioned, the originating access is still subject to FCC jurisdiction. As they're moving forward, you may see an order regulating or modifying originating access, and actually putting that on the wagon for a glide path down to a bill and keep regime. There is. As to whether that's going to occur, the FCC in its further notice of proposed rulemaking discusses whether they should do that or whether they shouldn't, because they view the larger carriers having a very high relationship, a long-distance relationship with the end-user customers they provide local service to. So it's not a foregone certainty that the FCC will need to may take action on originating, but it's certainly an issue out for comment. Another issue that is monumental for local exchange carriers under a rate of return regime is the recently issued public notice asking for comment on the prescribed rate of return. The authorized rate of return right now for interstate service is 11.25%, and the FCC has just released a white paper from the Wireline Competition Bureau staff that suggests that the rate should be between 8.06 and 8.72%. If it were to go to 8.72%, that would be a 22% decline in the rate of return for capital infrastructure that carriers put into the ground and is assigned to interstate services. This particular rate of return re-prescription doesn't affect the switched side of services, because remember, we have that eligible recovery amount that's frozen. The interstate revenue requirement has been frozen, and so that's not going to be affected. But special access services that carriers provide on the interstate side will be affected, and I anticipate state regulatory authorities re-examining their rate of return, their prescribed rate of return for rate of return carriers going forward. And so there's going to be an overall pressure, and this is a monumental change, overall pressure downward on rate of return for rate of return carriers at a time, ironically, when the FCC wants to encourage investment in infrastructure for the delivery of broadband services. So there's kind of a discontinuity, as I see it, in those two policy initiatives. That be that as it may, that's what we have. Now, let's turn our attention.
I'm going to take just a moment, Mr. Meredith. I want to check in and make sure Commissioner Fedorchik is still on the line. Commissioner, could you unmute for a moment and let us know if you're still there?
I'm still here, yes, and I'm having a just fine time hearing everyone except for Commissioner Kalk when he asked his questions. They're a little soft, but otherwise I'm following just great.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner, could you speak up just a bit when you ask a question? Thank you. All right, Mr. Meredith, please continue.
Fine, thank you. Let me address for just a moment the matters related to the May 24th filing. I believe it was probably received on the 25th of 2013 from the North Dakota Intrastate Access Coalition dealing with some
what I would describe as Scrivener's errors, dealing with only a few of the carriers. On page 2 of that document, there's an Appendix A, and that Appendix A lists seven carriers and approximately 8 or 9, maybe 10, changes to the rates. That is to say, rates that were not in the March filing are now put in the March filing, and they're listed. The correction is listed on the right in the second column of that Appendix A. Mostly, these deal with just, as I said, typographical or clerical errors in not getting the rate in the right spot. With 172 pages and with all the detail that has to be put into those documents, I hope you have some sympathy for the processing of that. And so I would encourage you to look at the May 24th filing as simply just a corrected filing of the March decision, and use that particular document in determining the approval or denial of the rates. And I would fully recommend that you approve the rates as filed. The rates in general, in my colloquy with Commissioner Calk, I described a little bit about what is happening this year. And if I may, let me go to the transformation order, which is 764 pages long, and I'm going to go to page 511, and that is a particular rule. It's the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 51, Period 909, entitled Transition of Rate of Return Carrier Access Charges. In that rule, there is a series of steps. We have Step 1, which deals with July 2012, Step 2, which is subpart C, Charlie, dealing with July 1, 2013. And this is what it says. It's only 3 sentences long. The first step was 2 pages long, and this step is very, very simple. It says, quote, effective July 1, 2013, notwithstanding any other provision of the Commission's rules, transitional intrastate access service rates shall be no higher than the rate of return carriers interstate terminating end office access service and terminating switch tandem transport access service rates and subject to the same rate structure and all subsequent rate and rate structure modifications. Period. End of quote. So what this says is that for this particular year, we have the situation where interstate rates, as described in the rule, are to be no higher than the interstate rates. And so we have effectively mirrored the interstate and intrastate rates. And that's what that document does that has 172 pages. That's what that document does. It changes rates and rate structure for carriers in the coalition to match their interstate rates and structure. And that particular document was prepared by John Stereolakis on behalf of the coalition, and I can affirm in testimony that those rates conform to the FCC rule as I've described. And so there shouldn't be really any issues related to, hey, what about this, what about that? All of those matters have been taken care of. We've had a year plus to deal with it, and so we have now a conforming document.
Your Honor, if I could ask a question on that.
Yes, Commissioner.
I'm nice and loud this time.
Thank you.
I believe your testimony, that's not the point, but if someone didn't agree with you, what would be the venue that we would know about that? If a Verizon didn't like the numbers that you had, would they be here today, you envision, or
yes,
would they have talked to you already?
Yeah, they would be appearing here today to talk, to say, hey, there's a North Dakota rate that is not conforming, and so therefore the commission needs to.
So they get a staff review of what you do, or how do you make available to the companies, to other entities that might not agree with you? How is that made available to them, other than this notice for this hearing?
Well, they also have, I'll have to refer to a counsel on the process for intrastate access challenges, but if they have a particular issue they don't like in the tariff, they can dispute that tariff when they get billed, and then the dispute would come back to, generally it comes back to the State Commission, but I'm not sure in North Dakota if it does come back to you or not. And counseled. Can you affirm that?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. So what happens here is if there's a this particular tariff gets it goes into place, and then if there's a if a carrier says, oh, that's not right, that rate is not right, or that process is not right, then they can dispute that billing, and then that billing dispute eventually comes before the commission, and the commission can make a determination.
I think we had some tweaks last year. What initially was filed, there were some changes that were done after it got put into place on that.
Yeah.
Do you envision this tying into anything dealing with a carrier of last resort? Any of the things we've talked about today, how that might affect that special status, if you will?
The status of carrier of last resort deals is a policy. It's a state policy that requires local exchange carriers, the carriers that have the connection to the customers, to provide services to those customers throughout a designated area. And that designated area is either called a service territory or a study area, service area, those types of descriptions. What it's trying to describe is a specific geographic area where that carrier has responsibility as a common carrier under Title II concepts of the Communications Act as a common carrier to deliver service to customers upon request. The process here is interesting because you might think, well, okay, let's think about this. We have revenues in 2011 that were frozen. Then the FCC has taken that revenue process of generating, of you know, the billing process generating that revenue, and they've moved it over to the ARC and also to the CAF ICC. So therefore, everything's cool. I mean, that's what you could possibly say. But do remember that eligible recovery amount declines by 5% every year, and it does not allow for any increases in infrastructure. In North Dakota, there's a phenomena that's unique to North Dakota and West Texas right now, and it's the oil extraction process, as you are well aware, and that requires investments in infrastructure, sizable investments in infrastructure in both of those segments of the country. The investment in infrastructure in Western and North Dakota does not allow a carrier to receive any additional interstate access recovery for services they provide. So one of their revenue mechanisms in recovering investments, infrastructure, the recovering the cost of putting in and operating those investments has been removed. That is a concern, particularly for the areas that are experiencing high infrastructure challenges. It's also a concern, as I mentioned before, in the overall policy for broadband deployment, that the FCC really wants to encourage the deployment of broadband, which requires more investment, and yet some of its policies are not quite yet fully ripe to produce a means wherein a business or a carrier can actually get a reasonable return and a kind of a opportunity to recover its investment costs in some return. As far as carrier of last resort goes, I'm going there. I'm sorry, that was a big preamble. The carrier of last resort, the FCC requires carriers to provide, in order to get any universal service, the old legacy universal service programs or this new program that they've just established, the CAF ICC, they require carriers to provide voice-grade service and access to broadband, the availability of broadband, or networks that are capable of providing broadband. But for rate of return carriers, for the rural carriers, the small rural carriers, it's only upon reasonable request. And that particular phrase, upon reasonable request, is very interesting. And it's the first time that it's really appeared in the federal policy annals. What that means is that at some point, the FCC envisions that for wireline service, there are some customers, potential customers, that shouldn't be served. They're saying you only have an obligation to serve upon a reasonable request. And if it costs too much to get out to that last customer in the last section of the county, then the carrier is supposed to say, sorry, I can't do that. That's from an FCC standpoint. Now, how that marries with carrier of last resort obligations that are really rooted within the state governance is a question, because this, the FCC didn't say, states, you don't have carrier of last resort regulation. You can't regulate to carrier of last resort. But what the FCC has done is they said, from a federal standpoint, there are customers that we're not going to serve with wireline services. We'll have to use satellite or some other thing, some other technology to get service to them. And how that engages with state state policies on carrier of last resort is something that's an open book right now. We still don't know exactly how those gears are going
to. I did not realize that state carrier of last resort was unique to North Dakota. I thought that was almost a federal backdrop that we agreed on. That's something for me to follow through on.
Well, the carrier of last resort duties are really organic to state regulatory policy.
Okay.
And it's really the state. The only carrier of last resort concept that you have in the federal arena is in Section 214 of the Communications Act, which is the eligible telecommunications carrier designation. And in order to receive federal universal, be eligible for federal universal service support, you need to provide service throughout an area. But that is not the generic or the organic carrier of last resort that most people talk about. And most of the time, that comes from a state policy or law.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Christman.
Your Honor, when the FCC has acknowledged that there will be some people that they just won't expect to get wireline service to, is that just a concept, or have they stated a certain dollar amount or distance or something like that that would give direction as to who is unservable and who should be serviced?
Very good question, Commissioner. The FCC put into its rule upon reasonable request, and then all the rural carriers said, what's the standard for determining what a reasonable request is? And the FCC hemmed and hawed, didn't really give a particular standard, but they did say that it had to deal with some financial considerations, that being able to finance the thing would be a consideration. So it's really subjective right now. In another matter, the FCC has brought up this question of how do we serve those customers way out there? And they have issued a notice of proposed rulemaking and have received comments and reply comments on what is called the Remote Areas Fund. And the Remote Areas Fund is supposed to provide voucher service, vouchers to customers in the very, very remote areas so that they can actually receive non-wireline services, either through satellite or through some fixed wireless provision. That particular fund is moving ahead, and I have the expectation that we'll see some final rules on the Remote Areas Fund within the next 12 months.
Follow up, Commissioner? Thank you.
So this, with regards to the May filing, as I've mentioned, this is dealing with transitional terminating access services. Generally, there's one provision for dedicated transport that deals with originating, but that's just a frozen item. That's not an item that moves downward over time. And with regards to that, I just wanted to finally just state and give you a vision of where this is all going. As you are aware, reading the trade press and reading the evolution of technology, that we are moving very quickly to an IP, an Internet Protocol world, where end user carriers and carriers that deliver services across the country are using IP technology, Internet Protocol technology, in a managed scenario. To efficiently route calls from one customer to another customer. And that particular process will continue, and also will require changes to policies and rules and procedures going forward. And the FCC is looking at that as well. The FCC wants to have a collaborative relationship with state commissions like yourself. And they have said, even in the terms of this terminating access regime, when we go to Bill and Keith, we still feel like we're partners. This is the FCC speaking to you as commissioners. They want you to feel like you're a partner. And even with their changing the methodology to Bill and Keep and going to zero by 2020, they still envision a role for state commissions to deal with issues such as transport, dealing with how calls go to a particular carrier. In order to avail itself of Bill and Keep, an inter-exchange carrier needs to deliver a call to a certain point within a network, within a local exchange carrier network. That point, the FCC believes, is ultimately determined by you, by the state commission. Not in terms of a tariff, but in their brief before the Tenth Circuit, they say that that particular decision is going to be dealt with in arbitration. So it would be an arbitrated issue, and then it would be decided through an interconnection agreement. And that's the architecture the FCC has to resolve these matters. So as a state commission, you can say, well, is that just throwing a bone to the state commissions, or is that really a meaningful partnership in order to regulate this particular arrangement? I will leave you to make that judgment as commissioners. But the FCC does at least put out that olive leaf, saying that there is a state-federal cooperation that needs to occur. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions. We've had this discussion with the commissioners, but I don't know if staff has any particular questions. We can address it at this time or however you want to proceed, Your Honor.
Thank you. I'll ask first whether the commissioners have any further questions, and then we'll go to the staff attorney and staff.
Your Honor, I would just have one more question. The for folks sitting in the audience too, I know you didn't come down maybe to testify, but it would be nice to hear, if you're interested, how this will be affecting each of your own telcos, if you're interested in letting us know that. But Doug, for you, this commission signed a letter basically saying we urge that, you know, people complete their phone calls. You know, the Google Voices of the world, the calls not being completed. How does that that mechanism of Google phone numbers and those things tie into any of this discussion at all? Because we're hearing, and I believe it's true, that they're not completing calls to some of these areas. Is that tied in? That must be the interstate charges, not so much the intrastate charges. But how does that tie into this picture, if at all?
Well, the issue of call completion is a very important one, and the FCC did, in its transformation order and subsequent orders, have tried to address the matter of getting carriers to terminate, actually these inter-exchange carriers, to deliver the call for termination. What happens here in the situation is that a carrier is given a particular call destined to a particular customer in an exchange. And what happens is somehow that call doesn't get delivered. And so the person on the calling end is sitting here waiting or getting an intercept or getting nothing, and the call doesn't go through. And the FCC did some investigation trying to find out why that is the case. And one of their findings was that there were some wholesale inter-exchange carriers that were not delivering calls to higher cost areas. And so they've made rules to say, no, you have to deliver calls. You know, this particular access regime change, this reform is making it easier and more. It's streamlining it, frankly, because all of those calls now are at the same rate starting this July and going down to zero by 2020. That is the long solution is that when it's Bill and Keep, then there won't be an incentive not to deliver calls.
Do you see a state role in that enforcement of the – because we've relied on the federal –
It's mostly interstate. I don't know of any states that are participating heavily in call termination issues. It's mostly – my experience has been that it's been an interstate issue mostly.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Christman.
Your Honor, do cellular companies pay the same monthly charges as this goes to 50 cents and then a dollar and on up?
No. The wireless carriers are not required to charge, do not have the ability to have a federally mandated access recovery charge on their bills. The FCC believes that the wireless carriers can regulate their end user rates accordingly, and if they need more, if they need more money from end users, they can just raise the basic rate for service. The question then is, the follow-up question is, do you see if wireless carriers, would they need to have this particular scenario, this particular arrangement? And when you look at a Verizon Wireless, for example, that is delivering a bulk of its calls to its own affiliate, which is Verizon Landline, then the issue of calls, the issue of this transaction is a wash, really. It doesn't make any material matter to the holding company. It's only when you have two parties that are involved that are not affiliated where you would have the arrangement.
And do the wireline carriers charge the ARC on Lifeline calls?
No, Lifeline. No, I believe, subject to check, I can check that and find out, but my recollection is that the ARC is not assessed to a Lifeline customer that qualifies. Now, there's a process for that the FCC has established just recently, this last year, to make sure that Lifeline customers are indeed Lifeline customers, and that there's a certification process that they have to go through to verify, et cetera, the Lifeline customer application, and then a continuing and ongoing recertification of that eligibility. And so Lifeline is designed to help the low-income customers that truly need that particular support, and the ARC charge is not assessed to those lines.
Nothing further.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk, do you have any questions?
I don't have any additional questions, no. Commissioner Kalk asked the one I was going to inquire about regarding the call completion and dropped calls, and Mr. Meredith covered that. So otherwise, I think I'm all my questions have been answered.
Thank you. At this time, then, Mr. Norell and or Mr. Fahn, commission staff, do you have any questions?
I do have a question for Mr. Meredith, and this is kind of a
Mr. Norell.
This is Mr. Norell. Yes, I apologize. This is a legal question, and it's also kind of speculative. So if it gets out there, I apologize, and you can reel me back in. But the question I have, as I understand it from your description, the pending litigation before the Tenth Circuit, it seems to be a jurisdictional question, and I understand that needs to be answered first, but. Are there any, have you heard of any, or is there any pending takings litigation on this? Because the FCC, again, trying to encourage the buildup of infrastructure, but reducing the rate of return, reducing what's going back to the local telecoms. Are you aware of any litigation there?
Yes, the issue of takings, which is a constitutional takings issue, has been raised in the Tenth Circuit briefings. And the FCC has replied that the takings claim by the petitioners is not ripe because it has to occur before it can be done. So that's where it sits.
Thank you. I have no further questions. Mr. Fahn, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Mr. Fahn.
Yes, thank you. I have some detailed questions, I guess, but the filing that was made on March 12th, is that totally replaced by the filing of May 24th, 2013?
Yes, with possibly the exception of some tracking pages at the beginning, as I understand.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Then, are there any in the filing? Are there any changes on the originating side? Any changes in rates or rate design?
There are a few, as like, let's go to Appendix A of the May filing. There's an issue related to originating information surcharges. And that particular item does appear in a couple of cases. As you can see, for like Dickey Rural Telephone Cooperative, there was a rate established by a group for non-LTR intralata originating information surcharge. So that particular item is a small correction, is a correction to the March filing dealing with originating intralata information surcharges. And also, that also occurred on intercommunity telephone company as well. And also reservation telephone cooperative had the same issue. And the issue dealing with the originating information surcharge had to deal with to make sure that the rate is that is listed is actually by exchange, that the rate is listed on an exchange basis. Okay.
Mm-hmm. The reason I asked the question mm-hmm. is because everything else, I mean, all the other changes are essentially mandated by the FCC, mm-hmm. but the anything on the originating side would not have been mandated by the FCC.
With the exception of there's a few on the switched access side, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right on the switched access side. But on the transport side, there is one piece that is mandated by the FCC for originating dedicated transport. And so that's if you see originating in any of the transport sides, that is a federally mandated change. Now, that particular change doesn't mean that it goes down to zero. It just means that it has to mirror the interstate rate for that dedicated transport.
Okay, rate and rate design?
I'm sorry?
The yes. Rate and the rate
Rate
design.
And design. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Rate and design.
So the only other question I have then is, I think it's the third page of the filing, of the recent filing, mm-hmm. May 24, and the other one I think as well, but there's a change on issuing carriers page.
Yes.
And it looks like there was maybe, it appears there's something was deleted there. And was that a carrier that was deleted?
Yeah, it's going to be a carrier. Let me go back. It's going to be a carrier that just due to corporate structure, that particular matter deleted. I'm not exactly sure if that's just deleting the spacing or if it's deleting a carrier. I'd have to look and see. And perhaps I could get back to you on that to see what that D deletion refers to, if it's just the spaces or if it's a carrier.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Assuming that it's just corporate structure thing, then we wouldn't have any issues. But if it was actually a carrier that was removed from the group, we would have to see if they've made their filing another way.
Right, and if it was a carrier removed from the group, my suspicion is, I'd have to go back and check, but my suspicion is that it's covered by another carrier that's listed on this same sheet, just because of that. But, yeah, I can get back to you on that.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Meredith? Mr. Hoag?
Your Honor, I would have two questions for him.
Thank you.
That would follow a brief conference with Mr. Fawn and Mr. Norrell at a point when we are ready to conclude.
Okay. Are you going to be offering the exhibit at this time?
Yeah, I would like to have a private conference, Your Honor, with Mr. Fawn and Mr. Norrell about the exhibit prior to offering it.
Okay. Do you need to take, 10 minutes?
Two-minute
recess? All right. We'll take, I know how these things are. We'll take a five-minute recess at this time.
Judge Fetch?
Yes.
This is Julie.
Yes.
I will have to beg off for about 20 to 30 minutes at 10:30, and I'll call back in and reconnect if the hearing's still continuing at that point.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Someone has left the conference.
Julie Pnorchak.